Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Efforts to change cultural memes or ideas of what we think sometimes result in the promoter of those new ideas being labeled with a negative banner. David Wan, the author of Simple Prosperity, Finding Real Wealth in a Sustainable Lifestyle, our guest in this edition of Radio Curious, was a regular contributor to a major Denver, Colorado newspaper in 2001 and before. Soon after September 11th, when George Bush suggested that people go out and buy things to promote the economy, David Wan suggested otherwise. His column was canceled by the newspaper editor, who then went on to suggest that he be tried as a terrorist by a military panel. In his book, Simple Prosperity, Dave Wan talks about using the affluence of our world to make it and our lives more comfortable and viable. When I spoke with Dave Wan in early February of 2008, I couldn't resist asking him to tell the terrorist story, and that's where we began our visit.
Right after 9/11, I was writing a weekly column for the Denver Post. And I suddenly was informed by a friend via a phone call that I'd better read the Denver Business Journal, where the editor of the Denver Business Journal was more or less skewering me with the idea that I was being unpatriotic because I was writing a weekly column about spending wisely. And here the president was saying, go out and shop, you know, buy anything. And so I guess what happened was, not only the editor of the Denver Business Journal, but also some CEOs of companies that were advertising in the Denver Post were saying, this guy, by God, this guy is saying some things that are running counter to what we believe America should be about, which is spending.
What did you say?
Well, you know, I tried to take it. At first, I just gulped and said, what? You know, what's he talking about? He claimed that I should be tried before a secret military tribunal. And so I approached him, I think, via an email, and I said, wait a minute, you know, I read your front page editorial, calling me a terrorist. And let me just, as opposed to getting aggressive, I said, let's go out to lunch. Let me tell you how patriotic I really am. Because, you claim that I'm threatening life in America as we know it, and that's correct. What I would like to do is create a better America. I'm extremely patriotic. I've worked for 30 years to create better solutions for the way for our way of life and the way we do industry, agriculture, transportation, etc. So I was aghast, and I figure I've by writing about that incident in the book, I've sort of leveled the score in a perfectly fair way.
Did that issue of you being a terrorist ever materialize beyond what you've told us?
No. I'm not literally a terrorist. I tend to be a person who works with ideas and puts them out there. And if people want to accept them, that's fine. If they don't, that's okay. You know, we'll keep trying, kind of thing.
The concept of the monkey wrench gang never appealed to you?
No. I've never been a political activist so much. I call myself a cultural activist. I think that really the quickest way to change the future of our society is to work to change the way we're thinking. And we think that's almost impossible, but if we just changed one thing, and that is our definition of success and our definition of value.
Maybe we could begin with what you would characterize as the current American definition of success, followed up by David Wan's definition of success.
Yeah, okay, that is a good starting place. In our current cultural way of looking at things, we have evolved into super individuals, and this goes back to 1776, when we began to see that liberation was important. We were under the thumb of the crown. You know, it was time to shrug off this poverty that we had. It was time for the individual to rise to dignity and equality. And at the same time, capitalism more or less put us under a yoke that said, you're going to have to compete with everybody else, and you're going to have to make it on your own. And there's not going to be any help in this, and you must become an individual who competes. And such ideas that as the environment is inside the economy became institutionalized. When you think about that, that's the way we look at the world, that the economy is over everything. And that we're part of the economy. The environment is there for us to use. So our mindset in terms of success is that we must accumulate the most stuff that we can in life, and accumulate the most status via stuff that we can.
Well, that's a concept that's been much more prevalent beginning in the 20th century, and specifically after World War II, than it was back in the time of the Revolution, where you began your characterization of success.
That's true, but it's been stepping up ever since that first die was cast. That capitalism, the free market can control everything. All you really have to do is worry about money. You make the most money you can, and that'll be good for everyone. And that assumption was born in a time when there were only 1/10 as many humans on the planet. That assumption was born in a time when nature seemed to be infinite. And, it was born in a time when we were still fearful about nature, that nature was something that had to be overcome. And we know now that nature is much more full of solutions than it's full of problems. We need nature. And yet we're dismantling it.
How then would you characterize success?
Success is looking at value in a different way. In the book Simple Prosperity, I talk about 17 forms of wealth that are related to money, but they don't center on money. They're things like connections with people, great neighborhoods that we live in. They're intimacy with nature and contact with nature that refreshes us. Using information in a way that substitutes for resources, mindfulness about how we spend so that we're not wasting anything. These are the forms of wealth. Time affluence is another one. These are the forms of wealth that we're actually trying to acquire, and we use money as the currency to try and get all these things and meet basic human needs, but my supposition is that we're not meeting needs well. So floundering around, we're not eating well, we're not sleeping well as a culture. We're so ill at ease that we begin to reach outside ourselves and we look for approval from others. We look for money from the world. We're fighting rather than going with the flow of life. And it's not feeling comfortable to us, and we all know it, and we're looking for a way out.
What are the foundations or the basis for your supposition that we're ill at ease?
There have been routine surveys of happiness in this country and in other countries since the 50s. The National Science Foundation has funded some of these surveys, and it's indicated that happiness has not, despite a doubling and quadrupling of income in the U.S., our level of happiness really hasn't improved. And you can say, oh, well, that's a survey. People will say that they're happy or not happy, but how do we know? It's very interesting to me that in our current technological expertise, we can actually measure whether somebody who says they're happy is happy. We can put them under an MRI screening. We show them pictures of kids who were playing in a happily in a backyard kind of thing, and that part of the brain lights up. We show them pictures of those kids who are disformed and physically challenged, and a different part of the brain lights up. There's pleasure centers that we can actually measure it, and it gets to be quite, it's not really that subjective anymore. It's objective as to whether we are content or not. And so when we measure people, we see that in many cases things like cooperation light up our pleasure center, but certainly the idea of a daily commute doesn't.
The MRI you speak of is the magnetic resonance imaging that allows areas of the brain to be seen on a computer screen.
That's right.
You also talk about happiness as a measure. You mentioned success as one and happiness as the other. Are you implying that in our culture now, people are unhappy?
Well, I think that there's evidence that we're relying on sources outside of ourselves to give us direction. And I think we need to be, this personal growth movement that we've been talking about in the, let's say, the baby boomer generation, it's often sort of dismissed as being greediness or self-involvement or whatever. That's one aspect of it. But another aspect is that we have been personally growing and developing in a spiritual way, and in a way that gives us self-direction. We're going counter to this whole commercial and this whole propaganda thing, and we're beginning to say, wait a minute, I know what I should be doing. I know what's going to make me happy. Don't tell me I need this product. Because really, so much of this advertising is about seeing if they can bump us off center and seeing if we can become dissatisfied and seeing if they can keep us insecure and fearful. Let's face it. I mean, it sounds like somebody ranting and raving about something, but if we start looking at what's actually being pitched to us, we see that it's much more in their interest to have us be dissatisfied so we'll continue to buy products to try and make us feel better.
Who is the they and the there that you speak of?
Good question. It's a cultural way of doing things. It's a machine that works, and so don't mess with it. You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. We're making more money all the time, and so we know this technique of saying you can't supply your needs. No, you need processed food. You know, we don't want you to eat fresh food because there's not as much profit as we can make out of that. We want you to eat food that we've diced up and taken all the nutrients out of, and then by God, you're going to need more food after that because, you know, this poor quality food isn't meeting your nutritional need. So, you know, I see what you're saying about, you know, who do we blame it on? And it's us. We blame it on our willingness to go along with a system that is dysfunctional. The culture is broken.
Tell us more. The culture is broken. But before you do that, I'd like to mention that we are speaking with David Wan, the author of Simple Prosperity, Finding Real Wealth in a Sustainable Lifestyle. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. David Wan will be speaking in Ukiah on Tuesday, February 12th at 7 o'clock at the Saturday Afternoon Club at the corner of Oak and Church Street in downtown Ukiah. David, the concept of it being broken.
Yeah, well, you know, if I can read a little section here on what we want. I really think it's important, Barry, that we begin to say, let's not worry so much about everything that we're moving away from and all the how we're going to get beyond it. Let's have a destination. Gandhi once said, speed is irrelevant if you're traveling in the wrong direction. And I think we just need, as a culture, we need direction. And I would ask, do we want a world in which species are on the rebound, or one in which habitats are being swallowed up by poorly planned development and computer-controlled machinery? Do we want clean energy provided with ingenious design, or dirty energy we literally pay for with our sweat, stress, and blood? Do we want a world we hurry through stressfully and fearfully, or a world worth slowing down for? And as I say throughout the book Simple Prosperity, there's really only one basic change we need to make to begin the shift to a new post-industrial era. Define and value wealth in wider, deeper, more holistic terms than money. If we begin to say money is okay, you know, it's not that money is a bad thing. A person's skills, talents, and good energy often result in monetary as well as other types of rewards. That's great. But the real value lies beneath the money in those things we crave instinctually. What money is worth ultimately depends on how it's earned and how it's spent. When it becomes the central focus in a person's or a culture's life, the resulting imbalance may well create poverty in other areas, reducing our odds of being truly happy. For example, a person may be poor in available time or have lots of time but just not know what to do with it. He may lack meaningful connections with people, be culturally clueless, or lack vitality and playfulness. Natural systems may be less abundant as a result of that individual's business decisions and excessive purchases, or the community he lives in may lose the benefit of his creative civic energy, all because the individual is off balance, like most of us. So that's where I'm coming from in terms of what is it we want to achieve, and we want to let all this stress and fear and doubt and envy and all this kind of thing go, and just say, I'm going to chart my own course here, and let me see how I do operating off of instinctual and more anthropologically based values.
That seems to me that it would work among people who have the discretionary wealth in money and in time to be able to make those choices, and be less likely to work among people who need something to eat now because they're hungry and their children are hungry and it's cold outside.
Absolutely. I've traveled in a lot of cultures, though, where the people make $300 a year. And what's happened with their society is they've said, we're going to find a way that everybody can eat. And in Costa Rica, I love the saying, when it rains, everyone drinks. And I do think that it's very true that we're going to be scrapping for those subsistent level needs, the food and the water and the shelter and so forth, until we begin to change the culture and change the economy and politics such that we're not so much in it for ourselves. But we get back to this idea of we. And I think that's one thing that I found very, in my research, I found it very refreshing that the European Union is moving in so many very interesting and advantageous directions towards creating a culture that works for everyone such that individual consumption is no longer such an obsession. You know, it's not so necessary for me to maximize my own income. If, in fact, I have all these public amenities, good education, health care, transportation systems that are for everyone, all this wealth of art and so forth. And so I see that for the individual low-income person to thrive, if we provide that safety net, that social familial safety net that reduces insecurity, then we begin to meet those basic needs and we can move on from there.
It seems at some point, or I see at some point, a contradiction in some of the areas of your book. You talk about the importance of creating a personal identity and a life story, yet you also talk about the rise of individualism and how that's been taken to an extreme. Can you discuss those two points?
Yeah, well, I think that when we began to associate the idea of stuff, material goods, with individual freedom, that's where we got goofed up.
What do you mean?
Well, and this goes back to, if I can just refer back to two books that were written back in 1776. Common Sense, which said that the individual should be regarded as equal to all other individuals. Democracy was this bright light. It's something that we're talking about, the equality of souls. And then Adam Smith came in with an idea, capitalism, that said, oh, yeah, the individual is free, and nature's unlimited, and we see that nature works kind of like a mechanism, and we have these technologies. Let's set the individual free to accumulate stuff. And it's going to be in everyone's interest, and we know we can trust people not to, be stabbing each other in the back and so forth, because, after all, they live right across town here.
But that in 1776 was substantially different, where communication and transportation was quite a bit more limited than it is now.
That's right. We had a lot more local trust. We had accountability. And now if we let that free market still run free in a situation where there is no accountability, then we start to have the Enrons, you know, where let's just turn off all of California's power and make a bunch of money on it.
One of the concepts that I've always considered interesting from my point of view as an attorney is, since corporations are chartered by the state to do a specific act, and if they work in contravention to their charter, the state should act to withdraw the charter.
That's right. We can just take them out of service. Well, and I'm forgetting the person who suggested 26 words in the charter of the corporation, added to that charter, could really begin to switch things around, because the main thing it says is you must make profit for the shareholders. That's the gospel. Now, what if it said you must make profit for the shareholders and treat the community in which you reside well, share the wealth with the community. You must treat the employee as a human being rather than as a machine. You must take care of nature, so that we're not destroying the really, as you know, what we're doing is we're drawing down the principal of our natural account as opposed to just spending the interest. A corporation really should be interested in, let's skim off the wealth that's accrued in nature by solar income, and let's use just that, and let's keep that principal in place because it's the principal that provides the wealth. If nature is wealthy, we don't have to be.
Let's talk about the rise of individualism. You have an interesting section in your book about how people changed eating styles from a common bowl.
Yeah. Let me read from a paragraph in the chapter on historical dividends. Back in the 17th century, the 1600s, it was very unusual for an individual to be seen wandering outside the walls of the town, kind of thing. That was crazy. People sat together on benches or either squatted on cushions. There were no chairs. You sat on a stool. The king and queen had a throne, but otherwise, the people were common. And in those days, most people ate from a common bowl and shared a tablecloth to wipe grease and gravy off their hands and mouth. But by the 1700s, individual bowls were in wide use, along with the recently invented forks that separated humans from the beasts they were eating. It became this whole rise of the individual over everything, over nature, over this rudimentary way of living. Private rooms began to appear and manners were developed to further distinguish man from beast. The pronoun I began to be seen more frequently in popular literature. Self-portraits became popular in art. And both personal and wall mirrors became common, literally reflecting a new interest in the self. René Descartes led the challenge proclaiming, "I think, therefore I am." But to me, the critical question is, what was he thinking?
Earlier in your book, you say in your chapter on personal growth, whether deliberately or by default, we each create a personal identity and a life story. What is the personal identity of David Wan?
In trying to meet anthropological needs, why should I separate myself from what humans need? One of the things that humans need is autonomy and freedom from being a social outcast or whatever, from departing from the world. And also we need to express our individuality. We need to be creative and expressive. We need freedom, so it's a balance. But in my personal life story is that somehow I've made a peace with where I am. I have a secure seat in the universe. I'm not going to fall out of that seat, and I'm going to explore ways that I think I should try to meet my needs. So my personal story includes dropping out of mainstream society about 11 or 12 years ago officially, but 30 or 40 years ago unofficially. I checked out from a society that was violent. I checked out of a world that wanted me to do certain things that didn't feel right to me. When I'm talking about what happened 11 years ago or 12 years ago, I was with the federal government. I was making $50,000 or $60,000. By now I would have been making $85,000 or something like that. And I was extremely bored, and I'm highly motivated by being creative, writing books. I make films. I play music. I love to create garden spaces, this kind of thing. And so I dropped out. I didn't retire. I just got tired, and I left the world of people with paychecks and went along to see if I could become a person who made my way being a freelance writer and filmmaker. And it took away income, but it really gave me freedom to express who I am and be creative and do my own thing, I guess you'd say. And so my personal life story is about not going with the dominant paradigm and saying, wait a minute, I'm going to do it, in a different way, and let me just see if it works. If it doesn't, all I've risked is my life, and I feel safe that my life is still under control, even if it seems to be lost. I'm not afraid of losing control.
Well, David Wan, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, there are a couple of questions that I'd like to ask that we ask each of our guests. And one is, can you tell us the single most important thing that you've learned in the last year?
Well, it sort of follows what I just said. My significant other, my partner, got breast cancer about 7 months ago. And this has been a year where I've had to say, life is going to throw you some real curves. And she actually took action just right away on this very small tumor that she had. She had a double mastectomy and followed that with chemo, and now she's beyond it. But I walked with her through that process, and I see that it's really important to live life on basic terms, and you try to find happiness in each moment that you can, and you don't worry about whether or not you're going to lose control of things. Yes, we're all going to die. But the thing is, let's go back to the basic needs, and let's meet those and see if we can find contentment in just the very simple things.
And an interesting book that you've read lately?
Well, the chapter that paragraph that I read comes from a discussion in Jeremy Rifkin's book, The European Dream, and it really was a mind-opener for me, this whole idea that privacy and the individual were really invented culturally in sort of the early section of our Industrial Revolution, and that those are the rules we're still living under, and these rules of capitalism and so forth. So I recommend The European Dream to anyone who's interested in seeing where our culture came from.
David Wan, thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thanks very much. My pleasure.
Dave Wan is the author of Simple Prosperity, Finding Real Wealth in a Sustainable Lifestyle. The book he recommends is The European Dream, How Europe's Vision of the Future is Quietly Eclipsing the American Dream, by Jeremy Rifkin. This interview was recorded in early February 2008. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. At Radio Curious, we appreciate hearing from you. Our email is curious@radiocurious.org. The snail mail is 700 West Smith Street in Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.